Welcome and good morning to the Sundance Reel on KPCW, broadcasting live from Whole Foods Market and sponsored by Mark Miller Subaru. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm John Wells. Good morning, Nell. I feel like dancing. This music is incredible.
Something about it.
Wow. We're going to be on the air with the Sundance Reel till 11 a.m. We'll be speaking with a series of Sundance filmmakers over the next 2 hours with a close look at Sundance environmental theme, The New Climate.
Today is Whole Foods Community Giving Day, also known as 5% Day, where 5% of the proceeds are donated straight to a nonprofit organization. Today, that's KPCW. So come on over to Whole Foods to say hello as you pick up your groceries this morning.
We're going to take a minute and tell you about our lineup over the next 2 hours, starting with...
Of course, starting with Debbie LaBelle, the Metro Marketing Team Leader right here at Whole Foods. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for coming.
Yeah, and then we have Icarus. It's a really cool film by Brian Fogel. It's a film about the intersection of international sports and politics, illegal doping, and a renegade Russian scientist.
Following that, we'll be looking at Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman. This tells the story of a huge and largely hidden, very unexpected conservation movement in America. We'll be speaking with the director Susan Frohmke and John Hoffman, the producer and author Miriam Horn, and also Dusty Crary, who's the Montana rancher featured in the film.
At the bottom of the first hour, about 9:36, we'll be speaking with Jennifer Bray and her husband, Omer Waslow. Jennifer is the director and the subject of the documentary Unrest. It's a film about the debilitating disease ME, also known as chronic fatigue syndrome.
Next up is the film Trophy. This film investigates the powerhouse businesses of big game hunting, breeding, and wildlife conservation. We'll be speaking with directors Christina Clouseau and Shaul Schwartz, who are partners both in work and in life.
That's going to kind of button things up for the first hour. Then we're going to go to NPR National News for 5 minutes. But wait, we will be back for the next hour.
That's right. And we're going to kick that hour off with Plastic China. This film follows the story of a young family who's both living and working in a sea of plastic waste and recycling. And they're trying to earn the money that would allow their young daughter to go back to school in her hometown.
Next, we'll be speaking with Jesse Bescher, who is the director, and Charlie Hoxie, who's the editor, for a short film called Harat. Now, we haven't gotten very much information on this film. It is a mystery. Only one sentence. One man's nightly ritual brings solace to the lovelorn of Harar. Nell, I'm looking forward to finding out what this is all about.
Intriguing. And then we'll wrap it up with Rumble, the Indians who rocked the world. This deeply insightful film cements how some of our most treasured artists and songs found their inspiration in ancient native melodies and harmonies that were infused with a desire to resist. We'll be speaking with the director, Catherine Bainbridge, and executive producer, Tim Johnson.
And of course, Nell and I would be remiss if we didn't just take a moment to thank Debbie LaBelle from Whole Foods, Roger Crawford, engineer extraordinaire who put all this together, and of course, Carolyn Murray, our producer.
Well, it's time to jump right into our first segment, and we'll be speaking with Debbie LaBelle, as we said, the Metro Marketing Team Leader here at Whole Foods. Thanks for joining us.
Hi there. Thank you.
So let's start with this. Today is 5% Day. 5% of proceeds go to KPCW. Tell us a little bit more about how Whole Foods does their community giving.
Correct. So, yes, we donate 5% of net sales every quarter to one specific organization. And we partner with local nonprofits in our community. And this is a part of our core values as a company to engage and partner with our community and support our community. So we've been partnered with KPCW for many, many years, and we're so excited to have you again for our 5% Day recipient.
Well, we always love being here on 5% Day. We are located kind of in the back of the store, right by the back door, near the deli area and prepared food. So as you come in, give us a wave this morning.
Yeah, please stop in and see us.
Yes.
Now, the big news with Whole Foods is that you have a new store coming online here in town pretty soon.
Correct. We're so excited about our new store. We are projected to open mid-October 2017. And so we're right on schedule for that. And we're just excited about all of the new features of our new store. It's going to be almost double the size. So that's very exciting. We'll be able to really better serve this community. And that's really necessary. We're going to have a tap room, which is very exciting. We'll have beer. We'll have local beer on tap. And we're also going to have a juice bar, which we haven't had before, and many, many expanded prepared foods options. So we'll have a lot of different food venues, and we're working with local companies to try to include them in our store.
Fantastic. Well, we have to wrap things up for our first segment here. We'll be back with Debbie again in the second hour of the show. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
When we return, we'll be with Brian Fogle from the film Icarus. This is KPCW, the Sundance Reel, live at Whole Foods. Stay with us.
Support for KPCW comes from the Wasatch Brew Pub, offering weekend brunch at the top of Main Street, featuring traditional favorites as well as midday Marys and mimosas. Private event space available. Wasatch Brew Pub, misbehaving in Utah since 1986. WasatchBeers.com.
Hi, I'm Courtney Johansson, owner of 350 Main Brasserie. We are pleased to support KPCW. 350 Main is located in the historic Golden Rule Building at 350 Main Street and serves contemporary American cuisine. We are open nightly at 5:30 p.m. Reservations, menu, and contact information at 350main.com.
The Sundance Reel is brought to you in part by Mark Miller Subaru. Love the experience.
And welcome back to the Sundance Reel on KPCW. It's sponsored by Whole Foods and Mark Miller Subaru. I'm John Wells with Nell Larson. We're broadcasting live from Whole Foods in Redstone. We're here till about 11 o'clock in the morning, so stop in and say hello. Joining us now, Brian Fogle, who is the director. He is the screenwriter. He is one of four producers for the film Icarus. Brian, welcome to Sundance Reel.
Thanks. Icarus.
Icarus. I was going to ask you about the pronunciation. Got it. Okay, very good. Icarus is a film about the intersection of international sports and politics while investigating the world of illegal doping in sports. And you, Brian, connect with a renegade Russian scientist, Dr. Grigory Rodchenkov, who's supposedly a pillar of the country's anti-doping program, yet he's really no pillar for anti-doping. Brian, this is exciting. What happens next?
The short story is I essentially get connected to Grigory Rodchenkov, and he turns out to be the mastermind of Russia's state-sponsored doping program for the last 15 years that he was in charge. And Russia never had an anti-doping system, and where the story leads to and what I uncovered essentially is the single biggest scandal in sports history, and Olympics history is being completely rewritten now, and they found 1,000 Russian athletes on the program proven beyond a reasonable doubt. And the film not only documents the journey, I essentially unraveled it. I got him out of Moscow, brought his public to the New York Times, and kind of an insane three-year journey.
Now, when you set out to make the film, you had a little bit of a different intent, right? You were planning to look at the effects of doping, using yourself as a subject, right?
Right. I mean, it started out a little bit of a supersize me kind of idea that I, aside from being a filmmaker, you know, I've been a cyclist, a passionate cyclist my whole life, and when Lance finally confessed, Lance Armstrong, I was looking at it more that he hadn't been caught. And so the world was essentially going, wow, they've caught Lance. But it was kind of like catching Al Capone on tax evasion rather than all the other stuff that Al Capone was up to. And in the case of Lance, here's this guy that had passed 500 drug tests clean. He's the most tested athlete on planet Earth. And they never caught him. He passed all the tests. And so I'm going, wait, something is wrong with this anti-doping system. Something is clearly really wrong with it, that the most tested athlete on planet Earth has evaded all the tests. And so I decided, hey, I'm going to set out on this journey as an athlete and as a filmmaker. And I'm going to find out if what Lance did can still be done. And if that's the case, well, what does that mean for every athlete that is under this program that is supposed to be being tested, not just cycling, but baseball, football, hockey, you know, every Olympic sport, etc. And through this experiment, I needed to find somebody that was going to advise me and teach me how to do it. And all the scientists in the world that I was talking to were essentially telling me that there were so many fallacies in the anti-doping system, was that, you know, any athlete who truly had the right advice could still get away with it. And I got connected to Gregory. He's running the WADA lab of Moscow, third largest anti-doping lab in the world. He had just done the testing for the Sochi Olympics. So the very last thing that this guy should have ever been doing was advising me on how to evade positive detection and doping control. And not only that, you know, it was completely against all codes. I mean, if a lab director who's in charge of the system is advising you how to beat the science, you know, that's a problem. Gregory and I struck up a friendship, and about a year and a half into making this film that I thought was going to be this Super Size Me-esque film, it turns out that Gregory is the mastermind of Russia's state-sponsored doping program. I thought he was a large salmon, and it turned out that he is the great white shark. And if you've been reading the headlines all over the world, or you know, the front page of the LA Times today, it's just been an insane, surreal story.
Brian, do you start your own car in the morning, or do you have people start your car for you?
That's it.
Who tests your food?
This is a
high stakes game you have gotten yourself wrapped up in.
Yeah, you know, as this kind of started to unfold, and I realized what I had essentially uncovered, what was happening. At the time, you know, I had went from essentially being the subject of this film and seeking an advisor, and Gregory in some ways was kind of my, you know, he was my guru, he was, you know, he wasn't the central part of the film so much, but he had helped me so much in that year and a half, and we had developed this friendship. So all of a sudden, when this guy is not only in trouble, he's got two FSB agents living in his home a day after November 9th, 2015. He's telling me he's going to be killed. He's telling me that his friends are telling him within the FSB that they're going to take him out. And I realized the gravity of this situation, and we had to get him out. And so at the time, it was just truly, okay, this is a friend. I wasn't thinking about the documentary at that point. I wasn't thinking about the film. And I didn't know at that point what he had actually done. I didn't know the gravity, the scope, how big the story was, what he had truly been involved in, that he was essentially answering to Mutko, and Mutko was answering to Putin. I mean, that was it. Wow. I mean, there it was. And I did not know that, and then he comes to LA and the layers of the onion just keep peeling off and peeling off, and I'm essentially sitting on all this evidence, thousands and thousands of files and spreadsheets and everything, for about 6 months as we work to translate it, organize it, and get it into a place to bring it to the New York Times. And then they went from there, and then I ended up in the middle of a whole WADA investigation. And I became the kind of the conduit between Gregory, who then couldn't speak. He went into witness protection program, federal protective custody. And so all of a sudden, I'm his mouthpiece to the world anti-doping agencies, the organizations of sports, the Olympics are writing me letters. I've certainly been concerned. I've been very nervous. I've been scared, especially since the other two people that were involved in the program are both dead. They both died of mysterious heart attacks at age 52 and 59 within 2 weeks of each other in Moscow. One of them had already talked to the Sunday Times reporter, David Walsh, who broke the Armstrong story. And the Kremlin, I guess, got word about that. And there's never been a true investigation into these deaths. But Gregory is certainly aware of what happened. And so it's been very nerve-wracking, incredibly nerve-wracking.
And so did you ever second-guess your decision to bring this to the public? Were you ever at the point where you thought, you know, I need to worry about my personal safety or Gregory's and we just need to cut this off?
You know, many times. But, you know, what happens is you get so deep into something and you... and at this time, I had, you know, been following this for, you know, now it was 2 years. And then Gregory came to the United States not only to... essentially so that he could live, but he had a story to tell, and he wanted to come forward with this information. He wanted this to stop. It was enough is enough. And he was the only man, literally, on planet Earth that had this information, that could corroborate this story, that had where all the bodies, the blood, the bullets, where it all was. He was it. And he was the last man standing, and he decided that he wanted to tell this story, and I guess in some ways chose me to help him do that.
Brian Fogel is the director, the screenwriter, and one of four producers for the film Icarus. Brian, we want to thank you and wish you best of luck with the film, and have a great time at Sundance.
Thank you so much for having me on, and hope everybody who's listening will get a chance to see the film.
I hope so, too. We're going to take a short break, for a little music break, but when we come back, we're going to have Susan Promke and John Hoffman, who are the directors of Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman, Miriam Horn, who's the author of this best-selling book, and Dustin Crary, who is the Montana rancher. Stay with us. We'll be back after this.
G'day. Ian from Campos Coffee, a KPCW sponsor. We're from Australia, and we've just opened our first U.S. location here. At Campos, we work closely with our growers to select the beans for our blends and single origins that are roasted in-house and delivered each day. Campos Coffee is open daily at the base of Park City Mountain Resort. CamposCoffee.com.
Support for KPCW comes from Crandall Capital with New Park Town Center. With urban amenities and services and home to restaurants, shops, entertainment, lodging, and residences. More information about New Park Town Center at 801-303-5440.
Hi, I'm Davey Ratchard from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain hosts winter events throughout the season, including the annual Torchlight Parade, New Year's Eve celebration, Spring Groove, and more. More information about all Park City Mountain events can be found at parkcitymountain.com.
Welcome back to the Sundance Reel here on KPCW Radio. I'm Nell Larson. I'm here with John Wells. And sitting here at the table with us today are the creators of the film Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman, including the directors Susan Fromke and John Hoffman, the producer and author of the book that was the inspiration for the film, Miriam Horn, and Dusty Crary, who's the Montana rancher featured in the film. Welcome and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I was lucky enough to be able to see the film last night. And the film is so positive and uplifting, and it tells this amazing story. And those are rare qualities to find in an environmental documentary. So my first question is to you two, John and Susan. Did you go searching for a really positive story like this, or were you inspired to tell this for another reason?
Well, the story of how this came about really starts with Miriam. Miriam is an old friend of mine and a very highly respected author who was telling me over lunch, casual lunch, about her next book. And she was telling me about Dusty, and she was telling me about Justin and about Wayne. And I said, Miriam, you know, we have to make a movie about this book while you're writing it, because you've done the hardest work of any film. You have found the characters. So, you know, we're halfway there if you have found characters for a film. And then I turned to Susan, who I have a long history of working with on films, and asked Susan to start reading Miriam's material. And Susan, you can take over.
And why don't you also give just a brief overview of the film? We haven't told our listeners much about the arc of the story.
Well, the film follows...
We'll just get nice and close to that mic.
Okay, all right. The film tells a story of four different individuals, and the way we phrase it is that these are unlikely conservationists. These are individuals who you would not ordinarily think are environmentalists or working with environmentalists. And we filmed in Montana, as Dusty's story is a story about ranching in Montana and their efforts to preserve the great Rocky Mountain Eastern Front. And we filmed in Kansas with wheat farmers, and we focus on the no-till system, farming system, which restores depleted soil. And we go into the Gulf of Mexico where we filmed red snapper fishermen. Red snapper had been a species that was becoming very depleted, and how they came up with an effort to save their fish and their livelihood. And it is a very optimistic story because it shows how people can work together to come up with great solutions. And sometimes it takes 30 years, but it can be done. And these are all stories that Miriam had found as well.
Susan and John, your film is just beautifully put together, beautifully filmed, and having Tom Brokaw with his voice just makes it so powerful. But I also watched the movie last night and it was great. Dusty, there's no recipe for the solution that you all came up with. And while you were working through this problem, how important was the responsibility that you felt towards your father and your grandfather?
Well, I think everybody that on these heritage-type ranches, multi-generational ranches, that's always tugging at you a little bit, and I'm sure it's with any family business, whether it's a shoe store in New York or anywhere. Those people that did the harder work before you and sacrificed, and those homesteaders and those early folks. My family was a little bit different when they came out to Montana, but... that's always on the back of everybody's minds that, you know, I can't let this go. I can't make a big mistake because I've got to honor those ancestors that are looking over me and making sure I do this right. And so I think it's me and everyone else that ranches out there and has farms, and Justin's the same way, I'm sure.
Exactly.
Now, Miriam, I'm curious, did any, you know, Dusty is obviously a very willing participant here today, willing to be on the radio and at the festival, but were any of the folks that you were working with and featured in the book kind of reticent, like not wanting to get attention for what they were working on? Maybe you fall into that category,
even
too.
Even Dusty took a little persuading, and he'll tell you that I kind of snuck up on him, that I just asked if I could come visit, and next thing he knew, he was part of a film at Sundance. Probably the toughest were the subjects in Kansas. Justin Knopp, who's one of the farmers in Kansas, who was anxious about seeming to separate himself from from his neighboring farmers. He was leery of being too closely tied to an environmental organization in a public way, and he's also just incredibly humble, and so, you know, didn't want to seem to be holding himself apart or above any other farmers. So he was always really, he said no actually several times before he said yes. And we finally kind of kept getting him to agree, first with me, that he agreed to just have me come out and spend some time with him and see how that felt. And then the same thing when we, you know, so I finally got him into the book, and then he turned, and then it was like, okay, well, now that you agreed to the book, how about a movie? And so we kind of had to do the same thing with the filmmakers of kind of say, look, we're just going to come out and meet you, and you still can, you can flee into the wheat field if it doesn't feel right. And now by the end, he really felt like he is very happy that he participated, because as he said, he feels like his land doesn't really belong to him. It belongs to the future. And that his story is the same way, that his story is such an important story to get out there, that it really belongs to other people, not to himself.
And John and Susan, and also Miriam, I'll put this out to you, whoever wants to answer this. Someone talk a little bit about the significance of no-tilling and how that has grown over the years and the advantages of that versus what we've done traditionally.
I think Miriam should take that because, and I'll tell you why, because it is a very substantial part of the book, and it's a complicated soil science. And so what we can do in the film is really explore the character of a farmer who would be interested in sort of going against tradition, But Miriam not only does that, but then she explains why it's so important.
So the reason, you know, for 10,000 years, for the whole history of agriculture, farmers have farmed by plowing the soil, by ripping off whatever was growing on it and by turning it over. And what we came to understand first in the Dust Bowl, when millions of tons of soil blew away, was that soil left naked and unprotected is highly vulnerable to being lost to the wind or lost to water. And more recently, we've come to understand that still worse damage is being done to this incredible life that's in the soil. It's in fact the most alive ecology on the planet. There is more biodiversity in soil than in a tropical rainforest. And when you rip through that soil and scramble it and turn it over, you kill all of that microbial life. And it's absolutely essential to crop health and to human health and to keeping soil intact. So if you stop tilling, if you emulate the prairie, as Justin does, you try to make your farm look as much like the surrounding native grasslands as you can, covered and with something alive in it all the time, you can rebuild all of that soil ecology.
And instead of taking nitrogen and artificially putting it in to the crops, they had these partnering plants that provided nitrogen, so it's a whole new way of farming.
Exactly. It solves many, many of the problems. I mean, their ultimate goal is to be self-sufficient in the way that any natural biological system is self-sufficient. It doesn't need fertilizer, it doesn't need pesticides. And if you can reintroduce that biodiversity and leave your soil undisturbed, you can start ratcheting back on needing to add things like fertilizer and pesticides.
And it's not only what you're putting in, it's preventing the release of the carbon into the atmosphere.
Yes.
Which I think was a big aha moment for us in making the film, in coming to that understanding that the plants are working so hard to, you know, sequester that carbon, because that's the building blocks of cells and every component of the plant. And when you turn that soil over, it then becomes volatile and it then is released. And it's one of the largest contributors to carbon emissions on the planet. So if we can really move towards a no-till, and we talk about this and we cite a few statistics in the film, you can really prevent one of the largest contributors to global warming.
So Dusty, you and some of your neighbors, your friends, were also featured in the film for your stewardship of the land and your conservation efforts. And that's very much the legacy that I get the sense you all hope to leave. But I'm wondering if you also hope that you'll have an impact through participating in this book and this film, and if that's part of your motivation.
Oh, certainly. And I'm just a representative of a small group of very, very dedicated folks. And we look at the Rocky Mountain front, and we've had a really great time there and a great life. And so the whole motivation was to make sure that future generations will have the same opportunities in the same place that we had. And so that really was the inspiration. And if that'll help by coming to Park City, I'm in for a couple days anyway.
Good.
Well, we very much appreciate all of you joining us this morning. Unfortunately, we'll have to start to wrap up, but it's an amazing film. We hope everyone gets a chance to see it. And so thanks to Susan Frohmke, John Hoffman, Miriam Horm, and Dusty Crary for joining us this morning to talk about Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman.
We do hope that you all get to see the film, but also buy the book. It's
yes,
the same
absolutely.
Title, Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman. Miriam Horn is the author by the book. When we return, we're going to be talking about the film Unrest with Jennifer Bry and Omer Waslow. Jennifer's the director and the subject of the documentary Unrest, a film about the debilitating disease ME, also known as chronic fatigue syndrome. Stay with us. And welcome back to the Sundance Reel on KPCW. I'm John Wells with Nell Larson. We're broadcasting live from Whole Foods in Redstone. We're going to be here till 11 o'clock in the morning. Come on down and visit us if you can. Joining us now, Jennifer Bryan, her husband, Omer Waslow. Jennifer is the director and she is the subject. I hope I didn't mispronounce your name.
Okay. It happens all the time.
Well, tell me the correct pronunciation.
Jennifer Brea.
Brea. Okay, Jennifer Brea. Jennifer is the director and the subject of the documentary Unrest. It's a film about the debilitating disease ME, also known as chronic fatigue syndrome. It afflicts 17 million people around the world. Jennifer and Omer, welcome to the Sundance Reel.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you here, I'll tell you that. Jennifer, I watched your film last night. It's very powerful. It's very moving. And your story is about tremendous love. It's also about tremendous loss. Lots of obstacles. It's about many, many questions and not so many answers. How does it feel to bring this so very personal journey to Sundance?
Well, it feels incredible to be here, obviously because it's an amazing festival, but also because the Sundance Institute was played a large role in the sort of birth of this film. And when I first started shooting, I was just shooting myself in bed on an iPhone and was bedridden. And, you know, they really took a risk in supporting the film very early. And so it feels like coming full circle to be here. And I never even thought at that initial point that I would ever be well enough to even leave my house again. So it feels really amazing to be here.
And what is it like to put such a personal story for both of you, to put that out in front of the public and share that with so many people? For many people, health issues are a very personal thing. We don't talk about them, you know. And so to bring visibility to this, what does it feel like?
Well, on the intimate stuff, I think in some ways we have it. Sharing the story is part of what helps to bring visibility, and so that was sort of the North Star that I think guided us through, which is how do we tell, this is Jen was the director, but sort of how do we use our story to try and draw people in, but it also, she was very kind, and so, in the editing, so I, you know.
You keep saying this, and it's not true at all.
I trusted the editor to not misrepresent me terribly, and that faith paid off.
Oh, boy. I mean, I think for me, one of the things that's been really incredible as I've started to sort of speak about the film and do sort of early feedback screenings is that what you realize, you were saying that health is sort of this private thing. And I gave a TED Talk last spring, and I just was swarmed by people who were all dealing with some kind of private pain. So, you know, chronic pain that they didn't tell anyone about, or treatment-resistant depression, or, you know, some folks had really debilitating disabilities that were invisible and they were hiding from, you know, their coworkers or the loved ones. And I think that we don't talk about health, but there are so many people who are suffering in some way. And I'm hoping that in addition to sort of, you know, raising awareness about this disease and all the issues around it, that it can sort of be a space where people can feel that because we've been so open, that they can feel safe to be more open as well.
Once called hysteria, called a number of different names, take a minute and describe this illness and the historical perspective from the past, but also countries like Denmark, how they're looking at it today as well.
Yeah, so it's the disease has had many names over the years, and I don't know that this was hysteria, but what I was diagnosed with when I first got sick, and many patients get diagnosed with who are also dealing with other conditions, is something called conversion disorder, which is the modern hysteria. So it was renamed. Hysteria was renamed conversion disorder in 1980, and really there's been this idea, stretching back to the 1890s, that patients, in particular women, can develop physical symptoms because of some subconscious trauma. So I was told that, you know, I was sick because of some trauma I couldn't remember, which sounded really unscientific to me. So I'm like, okay, there's something that happened and I don't even know what it is, and neither do you, but like, you know, it felt like a kind of a magic wand. And I think it's because medicine has a hard time grappling with what it doesn't know. It's sort of, I think doctors are trained almost as though what they are being given represents some sort of fixed or final state of what we know scientifically. And in reality, you know, our knowledge though is constantly evolving. And so patients with epilepsy used to be forcibly institutionalized, sterilized, and that was seen as a mental illness until the EEG allowed people to actually see sort of, you know, abnormal activity in the brain and multiple sclerosis. There was a big debate for many decades as to whether that was a, quote, real illness or a psychosomatic illness until the invention of the CAT scan. And so there's a sort of way in which, you know, unless we can see it objectively, we don't believe it, and we don't really, you know, it's sort of the testimony and the witness of the patient is kind of, I think, devalued. And so that's one of the things that I explore in the film. And I think there's been a lot of parts of the world, and it's even happened on occasion in the U.S., where patients living with ME have been forcibly removed from their homes because essentially doctors believe that their parents, in supporting them and taking care of them, are supporting what they call false illness beliefs. So the whole problem is not that you are sick, is that you believe you are sick. And if your parents care for you, they support those beliefs. And so we have to take you away from your family in order to be able to sort of, you know, put you into this sort of therapy that helps you understand that your symptoms are actually being generated by your mind.
And that has not worked.
No, that does not work. That has never worked. That has never worked. So that's a really been a kind of hidden issue. And, you know, and I think beyond that, I mean, the film for me is also a way to sort of, I think, explore some of these universal issues that, we will all face someday around, you know, our bodies and their fragility, around caregiving and around what happens when, you know, life throws you a curveball. And when you had one plan for what your life would be, I mean, my husband and I had just gotten married, and we thought that we were going to start a family and be traveling around the world and doing all of these things that we had, you know, loved doing together. And suddenly all of that became impossible. And so it's also about, like, how do you adjust to that? And how do you create a life of meaning in spite of these enormous physical obstacles?
Well, we've got time for just probably one more question. Looking forward, and I know we're just getting started here at the festival, but looking forward, you know, do you hope to achieve something with this film, like in the realm of research? I think you mentioned that, you know, the treatment for this hasn't really evolved too much. You know, where are you hoping to go with this in your wildest dreams?
Well, there's been some incredible science, really for decades, that has been grossly underfunded. And in more recently, I think there's been some very promising drug trials and a lot of things coming out. But what I'm really hoping is that the film can kind of end the stigma and also, you know, massively grow the scientific field. So, you know, bring new scientists in and also increase the funding that's available for the disease. Because it's really through science that we're going to be able to find out what causes this and ultimately how to cure it.
Well, we want to thank you so much for joining us this morning. I just wanted to ask one quick question, and that is, there was a time in the movie where there was some relief, there was hope, promise about living in an environment that might be drier or mold-free. Have you all moved to a drier, mold-free environment? Is there hope for yourself and for other patients that are afflicted with this by doing that?
So I have something called mast cell activation disorder, which a lot of patients with ME have. Not all, but many do. And so I'm really sensitive to mold, diesel fuel, strawberries, and spinach, I've come to find. And I moved to LA, and I feel much better there because it's dry. So I joke that I'm probably one of the few people who's ever moved to LA for the air. But it also makes Park City a really great place for me, so yeah. I'm glad to be here.
We're happy to hear that.
The film is Unrest. If you haven't got a ticket and you can't get a ticket, get on the electronic wait list. Go see this movie. We are speaking with Jennifer Brea.
Brea.
I tell you what. And Omar Waslow, I got that one right. And Jennifer is the director and the subject of the documentary Unrest about the debilitating disease ME, also known as chronic fatigue syndrome. Best of luck with your film. Enjoy your week here. Have some fun.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, we're going to take a little break, a little music break. When we come back, we're going to be talking with the filmmakers of Trophy, a fascinating film.
Welcome back to the Sundance Reel. I'm Nell Larson here with John Wells, and we are broadcasting live from Whole Foods this morning on KPCW's 5% day here at Whole Foods. So come down, say hello, and do your grocery shopping while you're here. We are now going to focus on a film called Trophy, and we're going to be speaking with directors Christina Claudio and Shaul Schwartz. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
So, John and I both had the opportunity to screen this film, and it's beautiful and it's touching, but it at times is really, really tough to watch. And so I'm curious as to, you know, why you decided on this. What was the motivation to take on this topic?
I think we started a little bit at a different place. Hunting was very foreign to me growing up in Israel, and I stumbled across pictures of a man posing with an elephant he'd just hunted, and I was outraged and angered. And Christina, who grew up in northern Minnesota, knew more about it, so we immediately fell into this very heated debate between us about what this means and why this could be bad or good. And it led us onto a road which I think surprised me a lot, that the issue is way more complex than it I understood from that initial anger, and that just kind of snowballed into the making of the film.
And give us a brief overview of what these, I don't know if opposing forces are the right term, but an overview of what the film is dealing with.
The film looks at both hunting, conservation, and putting economic value on animals. And on the other side, it looks at more the animal welfare side, and these two opposing worlds, looking at conservation on one hand, conservation on the other hand, but talking about it in two different ways.
Yeah. Shaul, your film exposes the complex relationship between big game hunting and wildlife conservation, and I found myself in watching the film going back and forth, and it's not black and white. It exposed the gray areas of a very complex issue. But I wanted to ask you about something personally. What was it like for you when you filmed the scene of Philip Glass killing the lion at the end?
It was hard. It was very hard. You know, we had that same. Mr. Glass also had an elephant hunt, which I think was the hardest for me and Christina to observe. It was earlier in the process, and it's just a majestic creature. And you really, you know, as you go into this, as I said, we started to understand why hunting maybe as an idea can make sense, but it's extremely emotionally hard for someone who's not a hunter to just witness it. I think part of what the film wanted to do is show that and you're right to point out that it's not an easy watch, and we didn't want to kind of give any discount to people to understand. But with that said, we also continually wanted people to feel what we were feeling, to think from the mind and not only think from the heart, if that makes
sense.
Exactly,
yeah. And Christina, when Shaul's talking about the elephant, the elephant was shot, turned, and started running away. The elephant was shot a second time, went down. I think its leg was probably shattered or something. And the elephant continued to suffer while Philip was getting ready for his photo opportunity with his kill. And it was tough to see this elephant laboring, trying to stay alive, breathing and everything. So it was a very powerful scene.
Yeah, like Shaul mentioned, you know, that was the hardest one for both of us, is that to watch this creation of this animal, this majestic animal, be shot by a hunter was very hard. It was quite emotional.
It's also something, ironically, we like, you go on this hunt and you anticipate it happening, and there's this buildup of now it's going to happen, and yet when it happened, it shocked us. Somehow we couldn't believe it. It's a strange feeling. And the other interesting thing that, you know, within a couple of hours, a lot of local villagers appear and they basically start chopping it up and taking meat. And as that sinks in, the complexity kind of unraveled in our eyes, that of course we Westerners come in with this idea, and it's a great one, that we need to conserve these animals that are on a horrifically sad trend of disappearing. But Africans see it so differently than our mindset, and I think that's something really important when we're trying to conserve the world, to remember how local people see it and to try to adopt to their thinking style, because we're not going to be successful if we don't understand what their needs are.
There's a line of thinking that maybe offering opportunities, more opportunities for big game hunting and things along those lines can also help protect these species. Did your mind change during the making of the film? Where did you land on that topic?
I think it did change a little bit. I think coming into it, you have the Western perspective of perhaps, you know, you look at these animals as majestic creatures. Lion is Simba or the Lion King, and it, our concept of it is very different from going to Africa. And in certain places in Africa, to protect the wildlife means to not have this human-wildlife conflict. So you go into these villages, as Shaul was saying, and for them, 2 feet in front of them, they only think about what is their next meal. Whereas us, it's very far away. There's a very much a disconnect. And so it was really important to watch how hunting, for example, trickles down into the communities, in that if you put a value on an animal, it can protect them because the communities will look after it.
And some of the facts that were brought out in the movie, I just want to mention them quickly. In 1900, there were 500,000 rhinos in the world. Today, there are 30,000. In 1900, there were 10 million elephants in the world. Today, there are about 350,000. These are pretty compelling numbers.
Yeah, I think, you know, this is kind of this almost religion of there's people on both sides of this that
of
are completely opposed. It's like one of these topics, like abortion. You just come in with a very sharp view, and usually, and I think the one thing everybody agrees on is the facts are looking bad. And so we didn't make an environmental movie that's a call for action. We made an environmental movie that we believe is a call for discussion.
A call to think.
And we really do believe that none of the sides have the complete truth. But those facts are, I think, what's going to help us, because everybody cares about it and at the end of the day. And I think that's what we can unite over and start debating, well, this is wrong, this is right. Hunting is overselling, but don't throw it completely out. Breeding is powerful, but where is the line that we no longer do these things? So we do have to remember that it's true for giraffes, it's true for lions, it's particularly scary for rhinos and elephants. They will disappear soon. It's not like some myth that will happen in a million years. It's right around the corner.
In the filming of this, did you encounter any reticence from the people that you were filming or trying to work with? Did the people that were hunting not want to be featured or vice versa?
I think at the beginning, we had a little bit harder time actually finding a hunter, for example, that wanted to be part of the feature. We did come up with some access issues, but then we started to really, you know, have empathy for our characters and be a part of their worlds. And at that point, it was much easier because we came in with this attitude that, you know, maybe we aren't going to agree on a lot of things. Maybe we aren't going to have the same views, but we're here and we're willing to talk about your story and tell your truth and let you tell your truth. And I think once we opened up to that perspective of, you know, being journalists and listening and understanding from their side, it became much easier.
I think if you're a journalist that has lost passion to give someone you don't agree with a voice, you're not a journalist anymore.
That's a good point.
So we don't agree with all of them, but we did want this film to give them all a voice, not take it light on them. There are a lot of things in the movie that show things that we believe are wrong, but we were fair and square to them, and I think they appreciated that.
The documentary is beautifully filmed, and there's this one shot of the elephant where you are pulling away. Can I assume that was with a drone?
Yes.
So tell me about drone making in filmmaking and how that has changed the way things work, because I tell you what, that was an extraordinary shot.
Thank you. So you're looking, the two people here did the whole filming of the whole movie, and this is kind of extraordinary for a doc because in the last 5-6 years, we've just seen so many tools, including the drones, brought to our, we're both photojournalists, so photography is something in our blood, and the look of a film is as important to us as its content. And what technology has done is make a two-person team able to carry tools like drones and gimbals and stabilizers that just make it look like $1 million, basically. And it gives you so much storytelling, when you're a visual person, it's just a tool that, you know, there's no words that could say what that shot says. And so we're very happy to have these abilities, and I really encourage filmmakers to, it sounds geeky, but stay with technology because it does actually add up to storytelling.
Geeky is okay in the filmmaking world, right? Well, we unfortunately have to start to wrap up, but thanks so much to Christina Clajot and Shaul Schwartz for joining us this morning to talk about Trophy.
Thank you for having us.
Enjoy the festival and good luck.
Thank you.
We're going to go to a couple of underwriters, and then we're going to go to NPR National News for 5 minutes, and then Nell and I will be back for the second hour of the program. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Davey Ratchard from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain hosts winter events throughout the season, including the annual Torchlight Parade, New Year's Eve celebration, Spring Groove, and more. More information about all Park City Mountain events can be found at parkcitymountain.com.
Support for KPCW comes from Crandall Capital and New Park Town Center, with new retail spaces and a year-round community development. Information about New Park Town Center is available at 801-303-5440.
This is KPCW Park City, home of award-winning local news, great music, and useful information, especially this winter, traffic and weather. Stay tuned to KPCW, where we've got your Wasatch back.
Well, now we've got about 55 seconds until we go to NPR. That was a pretty good first hour.
I think it was. Amazing films that we're getting to
powerful
talk to this morning.
Films,
yeah.
Trophy, yeah. Unrest. I mean, all of them. It's just very exciting. You know, I also wanted to, and you and I both wanted to once again thank Roger Crawford, our engineer extraordinaire, for putting this all together. And, of course, Joel and Carolyn Murray, who is our producer.
That's right. It takes a big team to put on this Whole Foods effort every year, and we always have a lot of fun with it.
Yeah. So everybody stay tuned. We're going to be back right after this. We're going to have National Public Radio News, and then Debbie's going to be back from Whole Foods. We're going to be talking to her about a whole bunch of different things, so stay with us.